A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one about surveillance. The real thing, not the Hollywood version. He's asking whether it's actually as boring as it looks on screen. How good these officers are at blending in. Whether there are people who do this, and only this, for a living. And how deep the training and techniques go. Given that our undercover episode touched on how undercover work only happens when surveillance fails to produce admissible evidence, this is the logical step back. What does the surveillance itself look like?
The honest answer is, it looks boring, but boring in a very specific, intentional way that movies almost never capture. The Hollywood image is two guys in a van, drinking terrible coffee, making small talk, and then suddenly, action. Real surveillance is a team of 4 to 6 officers minimum, sometimes 20 plus, running a choreographed rotation where boredom is actually the goal. If you're not bored, something's gone wrong.
Boredom is a feature, not a bug.
And that's the part that's hardest to train. The FBI's surveillance training program is 12 weeks of full-time instruction, followed by a full year of field mentoring. 12 weeks just to learn how to be bored properly. They teach foot surveillance, mobile surveillance with single and multiple vehicles, and technical surveillance, covert cameras, trackers, the works. But the thread running through all of it is patience. You're waiting for a moment that might come in 5 minutes or 5 weeks, and you cannot check out mentally during any of it.
The coffee and small talk from the movies. That's the wrong image entirely. What's actually happening in that van?
The van isn't even where most of the observation happens. That's one of the biggest misconceptions. The van is usually the mobile command post. It's where the team leader sits, coordinating radio traffic, logging everything. The actual eyes on the target are on foot, or in separate vehicles positioned at choke points. A standard team structure has the primary. That's the officer closest to the target, usually on foot. The secondary supporting a block or two back, the tertiary doing overwatch from a fixed position, and the command post tying it all together. Each role has specific radio protocol. When the primary says contact, that means the target is in view. Box means the target entered a building. Mobile means they're in a vehicle and you're following.
They're not wearing fake beards.
They are absolutely not wearing fake beards. This is the thing. Professional surveillance officers don't wear disguises. They practice what's called gray man theory. You dress to be unremarkable for whatever environment you're in. In a business district, that means a suit that's off the rack boring, not too sharp, not too sloppy. In a park, you're a jogger. On a street corner, you might be a couple having an argument. Two officers who look like they're in the middle of a domestic dispute, and nobody looks twice at a couple arguing.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability, but for surveillance.
I don't even know what that means, but yes. The point is, you want to be forgettable. The biggest threat isn't the target spotting you. It's the target's neighbor noticing that the same jogger has been stretching by the same lamppost for 3 hours. Humans are pattern recognition machines. We notice things that don't fit. So the entire craft is built around fitting so well that you become invisible.
What happens when the target is trained to spot exactly that? Because presumably, organized crime and espionage targets know these techniques.
That's where it gets into the chess match. Targets use counter-surveillance. The classic move is called dry cleaning. You take 4 consecutive left turns. In a vehicle, that creates a loop that forces anyone following you to either complete the loop and be obvious, or break off and lose you. On foot, you enter a store with 2 exits, or you step onto a subway car and step off at the last second before the doors close. The surveillance team counters this with something called leapfrogging. The primary hands off to the secondary, who hands off to the tertiary, so the target never sees the same face twice. And they pre-plan for dead ground, areas where you can lose visual contact. Every operation has a map with dead ground marked, and the team has pre-positioned assets to cover each blind spot before the target even gets there.
That's a term I haven't heard. So it's the physical equivalent of a blind spot in a security camera network.
And professional teams spend hours doing what's called a REXI reconnaissance, of the area before the operation even starts. They identify every dead ground, every choke point, every place the target could force a handoff or try to burn the team. Then they build the operation plan around covering those gaps. It's methodical, which brings us back to the boredom. You spend 3 days doing reconnaissance for an operation where the target walks from their house to a coffee shop and back. That's a win. That's what success looks like.
The adrenaline moments, the split-second decisions, those are rare, but when they happen, the entire operation hinges on them.
That's the paradox of the job. 90% of the time, nothing happens. But the 10% that is of boring requires decisions made in seconds that can make or break a case, or get someone killed. A target suddenly changes direction, or spots the secondary and starts running, or pulls a weapon. The officer has to decide instantly, do I break cover and intervene, or do I maintain the operation and call it in? There's no time to consult the team leader. That's why the training is so long. They're drilling those decision trees until they become instinct.
Let me ask about the people who do this. Are there officers who do surveillance and only surveillance for their entire careers?
Most major police departments and federal agencies have dedicated surveillance units. The UK's Metropolitan Police Flying Squad has been doing this since 1950. They're one of the oldest continuously operating surveillance units in the world. They've used everything from ice cream vans to courier bikes over the decades. In the US, the FBI has the Special Operations Group. The DEA has surveillance specialists who spend years on nothing but tracking cartel movements, and the NYPD's Strategic Response Group does what they call flash surveillance on suspected terrorists, teams of 20-plus officers rotating every 15 minutes to avoid being burned.
15-minute rotations. So the target never sees the same face twice in a single hour.
And that's for high-risk targets where the consequences of being spotted aren't just losing the case. They're potentially lethal. The Sinaloa cartel operation in Arizona a few years back, DEA teams used a combination of fixed-wing aircraft and undercover vehicles to track drug shipments for 18 months. 18 months of continuous surveillance. That's not a stakeout, that's a lifestyle.
I can't decide if that's impressive or existentially depressing.
It's both. And it speaks to the kind of person who does this work. You need an almost meditative tolerance for monotony, combined with the ability to snap into high alert mode without warning. The FBI's psychological screening for surveillance candidates specifically looks for people who can sustain attention during long periods of low stimulation. It's not about being an adrenaline junkie. It's about being someone who can watch paint dry for 6 hours and still notice when a single crack appears.
Like adopting a feral cat. You don't pick the personality. The personality picks you.
Actually, not a bad analogy. These are people who find satisfaction in the craft itself. The perfect handoff. The clean radio call. The operation where the target never knew they were being watched and the evidence file is immaculate. That's the win condition, not the dramatic arrest. That's someone else's job. The surveillance team's job is to document, 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 and never be seen.
Speaking of documentation, let's talk about the technology side, because my mental image is still stuck in the telescopic lens era. What are these teams actually using now?
It's shifted dramatically in the last decade. The old model was analog. You had a camera with a long lens, you took photographs, you wrote notes. Now it's digital and networked. Modern teams use real-time video feeds from drones, pole cameras, covert body-worn cameras that stream back to the command post. There are systems that can track a target's cell phone via Stingray devices. Those are cell site simulators that mimic a cell tower and force nearby phones to connect. And yes, with warrants, they can access IoT devices, smart doorbells, traffic cameras, even some connected car systems.
The warrant part is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
This is where the legal tightrope comes in. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable search and seizure, and there's a whole body of case law about what constitutes a search in the digital age. The big one is United States v. Jones in 2012. The Supreme Court ruled that attaching a GPS tracker to a car without a warrant violates the Fourth Amendment. That forced a shift away from physical trackers and toward methods that don't require physical trespass, like stingrays, or just good old-fashioned visual surveillance from public spaces.
Because if you're on a public street, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy.
That's the general principle, yes. But it gets complicated fast. If you're using a drone to look into someone's backyard, is that a search? Courts are still working that out. And there's also the minimization requirement. When surveillance captures innocent third parties, which it inevitably does, the team has to minimize that intrusion. You can't just record everyone on the street for 18 months. You have to stop recording when the target enters a private space, where they do have an expectation of privacy, or when the recording is capturing unrelated activity.
The technology is impressive, but it's also a legal minefield, and I'd imagine the human element is still what makes or breaks an operation.
That's the conclusion every experienced surveillance officer lands on. Drones lose line of sight. A target who sees a drone hovering nearby will immediately know they're being watched. That's actually one of the limitations of drone surveillance that doesn't get talked about enough. A drone is obvious. A human being who looks like they belong there is not. The most sophisticated piece of equipment in any surveillance operation is still the officer's brain, their situational awareness, their ability to read a situation and make a judgment call that no algorithm can make.
Let me pull on that thread about situational awareness. What does it actually feel like to be under surveillance? If I'm the target, what are the tells that a trained officer is watching for?
The most common tell is someone who suddenly changes their routine or looks over their shoulder. It's called a security check, and it's the number one sign that a target is surveillance conscious. If you're walking down the street and you suddenly stop to tie your shoe while glancing behind you, every surveillance officer within visual range just noted it. If you take an unusual route, if you speed up or slow down for no apparent reason, if you enter a building and immediately exit through a different door, all of those are red flags.
The advice for someone who suspects they're being followed is to not do any of that.
The best counter-surveillance technique for a civilian is to act completely normal and gather information. There's something called the bus test. If you get on a bus and the same person gets on, that's a red flag, but you don't react. You note their description, you note the time and location, and you continue your day. If it happens again with the same person, now you have a pattern. But the moment you start doing dry cleaning maneuvers, you've confirmed to the surveillance team that you're aware of them, and they'll either back off and hand you to a new team or escalate. They might increase the team size to make handoffs more frequent and harder to spot. They might switch to technical surveillance, drones, pole cameras, trackers, so they can maintain coverage from further away. Or, in an intelligence context, they might go to what's called a comb, a large team that fans out across an area so that no matter which direction the target goes, someone is already there waiting. It's resource-intensive, but it's almost impossible to beat as a target.
The surveillance equivalent of resistance is futile.
And that's the asymmetry of professional surveillance. The target is one person, maybe with a small team. The surveillance unit can deploy a dozen officers, multiple vehicles, aircraft, technical assets, and a command post with real-time coordination. The target's only real defense is to not do anything incriminating while in public view, which, for a criminal enterprise, is not a sustainable business model.
Let's talk about the training pipeline. 12 weeks at the FBI, a year of field mentoring. What does that actually look like day to day?
The FBI program breaks down into phases. The first phase is foot surveillance, just learning to follow someone on foot through an urban environment without being spotted. They start in controlled exercises, then move to live environments where the target is an instructor who's actively trying to detect them. The second phase is mobile surveillance, single vehicle, then multi-vehicle teams doing leapfrog patterns on highways and city streets. The third phase is technical, covert camera installation, tracker placement, drone operation. And woven through all of it is radio discipline, report writing, and legal training.
The least glamorous part of any law enforcement job?
The most important for surveillance. If it's not in the report, it didn't happen. The evidence file has to be detailed enough to support prosecution, which means timestamps, locations, descriptions, and a clear chain of custody for any photographic or video evidence. A single gap in the log can get the whole case thrown out. So officers are trained to document constantly, voice notes during the operation, written reports immediately after. The paperwork is part of the tradecraft.
The field mentoring year, is that essentially an apprenticeship?
It's exactly an apprenticeship. You're paired with a senior surveillance officer who reviews every decision you make, every report you write, every radio call. They'll deliberately put you in situations where you have to make judgment calls and then debrief you afterward. The mentor is also evaluating whether you have the temperament for the work. Some people wash out during the field mentoring year because they can't handle the boredom, or they get too amped up during the high-stress moments and make bad calls, or they simply can't blend in. They have a look or a mannerism that draws attention, and no amount of training can fix it.
There's something almost Darwinian about that. The environment selects for a very specific type of person.
It's not the person who would volunteer for this job. That's one of the things that surprised me when I was reading about this. The people who actively want to do surveillance are often not the best candidates. The best surveillance officers are often people who were recruited into it because someone else noticed they had the right temperament, patient, observant, unremarkable in the best possible way. They're not the ones who grew up wanting to be James Bond. They're the ones who can sit in a car for 8 hours and still be alert enough to notice when a target's body language changes.
The James Bond types are probably the ones who burn themselves in the first week.
The ego is the enemy in surveillance work. You're not the star of the show. You're a piece of infrastructure. Your job is to be a reliable sensor that feeds information to the team leader, who feeds it to the case agent, who feeds it to the prosecutor. The surveillance officer who wants credit for the arrest is in the wrong line of work.
Covering the covers. Nobody's supposed to know you were there at all.
If you do it right, they never will, which creates a weird professional dynamic. The best surveillance officers are the ones whose work is invisible. Their successes are classified, their techniques are sensitive, and their names never appear in the news. It's a career built on not being noticed.
Let me shift to something the prompt asked about. How does this compare to private sector surveillance? Corporate espionage, private investigators, that world.
Private investigators use many of the same techniques but operate under different legal constraints. A PI can't get a warrant for a stingray device. They can't call in a police helicopter for aerial coverage. They're limited to what's legally available to any private citizen: visual surveillance from public spaces, public record searches, open source intelligence. The tools are simpler, which means the craft has to be sharper. A good PI doing a workers' comp fraud case is often doing more with less than a federal surveillance team.
The legal constraints are tighter because they don't have qualified immunity or law enforcement protections.
A PI who gets caught trespassing to install a camera is facing criminal charges and a civil lawsuit. A police surveillance team operating under a warrant has legal cover, as long as they stay within the scope of the warrant. So the PI has to be more creative, more patient, and more careful. It's surveillance on hard mode.
Which brings us to the broader question of where this is all heading. AI-powered surveillance, facial recognition, gait analysis, predictive tracking is getting cheaper and more capable. What does that mean for the human surveillance officer?
I think the role shifts from discovery to confirmation. Right now, a lot of surveillance is about discovering what the target is doing, where they go, who they meet, what their patterns are. As AI gets better at analyzing digital exhaust, cell tower pings, license plate readers, social media, financial transactions, a lot of that discovery work can be done without putting a human being on the street. The human officer then gets deployed to confirm what the AI suggests and to provide the contextual interpretation that algorithms can't.
The algorithm can tell you that the target visited this address 3 times this week. It can't tell you whether they looked nervous when they walked in.
And it can't testify in court. The human officer is still the one who has to get on the stand and say, "I observed the defendant do X at Y time on Z date." That testimony, backed by contemporaneous notes and documentation, is what gets convictions. An AI-generated timeline is not admissible evidence in the same way.
At least not yet. Give it 5 years, and there will be a Supreme Court case about exactly that.
There almost certainly will be. And in the meantime, we're also seeing the rise of counter-surveillance as a service, companies that help executives and celebrities detect and avoid being followed. They do bug sweeps, they run counter-surveillance driving patterns, they train clients in situational awareness. It's a legitimate business, but it's also a tool that criminals can use. The same techniques that protect a CEO from corporate espionage can protect a drug lord from the DEA.
The arms race never ends. Better surveillance creates demand for better counter-surveillance, which creates demand for better surveillance.
The fundamental asymmetry remains. The surveillance team has resources, coordination, and the initiative. They choose when and where to watch. The target has to be lucky every time. The surveillance team only has to be lucky once. Or rather, they don't need luck at all. They need patience, professionalism, and the discipline to wait for the target to make a mistake.
Which loops us back to the boredom. The patience is the whole game.
It really is. I came across this quote from a retired flying squad officer. He said that surveillance is hours of boredom punctuated by seconds of terror, followed by months of paperwork. And he wasn't joking. The boredom is the job. If you can't do the boredom, you can't do the work.
The Hollywood version gets exactly one thing right. It is excruciatingly boring. They just misunderstand why, and they skip over the part where the boredom is the skill.
They almost always show a lone operative doing everything. The surveillance, the photography, the decision-making, the chase. Real surveillance is a team sport with a paper trail. The lone wolf surveillance officer is a fiction. You can't maintain visual on a moving target through an urban environment by yourself. You need handoffs. You need overwatch. You need a command post coordinating the whole thing. The minimum is 4 to 6 officers for even a basic operation.
Of course there are. Nobody in Hollywood wants to film 6 people sitting in cars talking on radios for 2 hours.
Which is a shame, because that's where the actual craft lives. The radio discipline alone is fascinating. Every transmission is structured. Who you are, who you're calling, what you're reporting, no dead air, but no chatter either. If you listen to a surveillance net, it sounds almost like air traffic control. Clinical, precise, minimal. Because every unnecessary word is a distraction that could cause someone to miss a critical update.
The target has no idea. This entire invisible infrastructure is wrapped around them.
That's the goal. The target goes about their day, does whatever they're going to do, and never once realizes that a team of professionals is documenting their every move. The first time they find out is when the prosecutor presents the evidence in court. Timestamps, photos, video, logs, all of it showing exactly what they did and when. That moment of realization, when they understand they were being watched the whole time and never knew, that's the payoff for 18 months of boredom.
The ultimate, we got you moment, delivered in triplicate with exhibits A through Z.
It's worth noting that this is also why surveillance is preferred over undercover work whenever possible. Undercover operations are dangerous, legally complex, and psychologically damaging for the officers involved. Surveillance is safer, cleaner, and produces more reliable evidence. Undercover is the last resort, when surveillance can't get close enough, or when you need direct testimony about what was said behind closed doors.
Which is exactly where our previous conversation picked up. Surveillance fails, undercover begins. It's a hierarchy of intrusion, and surveillance is the first rung.
The rung that handles the vast majority of cases. Most criminal investigations never need an undercover officer. They need a surveillance team that can document the target's activities well enough to support a search warrant or an arrest. The surveillance is the engine of the investigation. Everything else, interviews, forensics, undercover work, is built on top of what surveillance provides.
What should the average person take away from all this, other than that the movies are lying to them?
I think there are 2 practical takeaways. One is the bus test. If you ever suspect you're being followed, don't react. Don't do dry cleaning. Just note details and see if a pattern emerges. The second is broader. When you're in public, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. That's the legal standard, and it's the operational reality. Anything you do on a public street can be observed, documented, and used as evidence. That's not a value judgment. It's just how the law works, and it's what makes surveillance possible as an investigative tool.
The public square is public.
It sounds obvious, but people forget it constantly. They have conversations on public sidewalks that they wouldn't have in their living rooms. They meet people in public places thinking nobody's watching, and most of the time, nobody is. But the capability exists, and when it's deployed by people who are very, very good at not being seen.
That's the note I want to end on. The invisibility. These are professionals whose entire job is to be unremarkable, to blend in, to leave no trace. They're the background characters in everyone else's life, and that's by design. The next time you're in a coffee shop and you see someone who's just not reading, not on their phone, not doing anything in particular, you probably won't notice them at all. And if you do, you'll forget them 5 seconds later. That's the gray man, and that's the craft.
Chilling and impressive in equal measure.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1960s, linguists studying kinship terminology in Cape Verde discovered a community where children addressed their maternal uncles using the same term reserved for household pests, a behavioral anomaly traced to a generations-old family feud that had restructured the local kinship vocabulary.
Right. Where does this leave us? The watchers are watching, the technology is advancing, and the line between public safety and privacy keeps shifting. The open question I keep coming back to is, what happens when the watchers themselves are watched? When every surveillance officer has their own digital exhaust, their phone pings, their license plate reads, their face in someone else's doorbell camera, and the targets start using the same tools against them, the asymmetry might not last forever.
That's exactly the tension that's going to define the next decade of this field. Counter-surveillance as a service is already a growing industry. Give it a few more years, and we might see a world where anyone with a few $100s can run a counter-surveillance sweep that would have required a government agency a decade ago. What does surveillance look like when the target has the same tools as the team?
A question for another episode, I suspect. For now, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this show running, and thanks to all of you for listening. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com for every episode, show notes, and links to subscribe. We'll be back soon with another one.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.